Hi everyone, welcome back to Brown Game Strong. I'm Mitali, and I'm super excited to bring to you a brand new guest in this episode. Her name is Jyoti Patel. She's an author and has just released her debut novel, The Things That We Lost. It is a coming-of-age story told from the perspectives of Nick, who's 18, and his British Indian mother, Avni. Jyoti takes us through the past and present as Nick searches for answers surrounding the circumstances of his father's death that occurred whilst Avni was still pregnant with Nick, all whilst overcoming his own experiences as a mixed-race teenager in the UK after Brexit. In this episode, we discuss Jyoti's process of writing this novel whilst managing a full-time career in marketing to winning the Murky Books Prize, which, did you know, is chaired by Stormzy. We also talk about the themes overarching the book, such as grief and mental health, specifically that within the men in our community, as well as the Gujarati Kenyan experience, which I found hasn't really been spoken about too much in the mainstream. Also, if you do enjoy the episode, please leave a like, subscribe, rating, you know the drill. It does allow for more people to find out about it, and it really helps the podcast out. So I'd really appreciate it. All right, let's get into it. Welcome, Jyoti, to Brand Game Strong. It is such a pleasure to have you, and I have been reading your book over the last few days, so I'm just really excited to be able to grill you. And how often do you get to actually talk to the author who's written the book that you've been reading the last few days? So I find it's something that's like really exciting about running a podcast. So yeah, it's great to have you. How are you doing today? How's your day been? How's your week been?
Thank you so much. Really excited to speak to you. And yeah, it's been really lovely. It's been maybe like, I think 3 weeks now since the book came out. So I feel like it's that really special period where it's sort of settled in a little bit, but I'm still walking past shop windows and seeing it there, and seeing it in bookshops and seeing people online reading it, and have had lots of friends and family sort of finish it around the last week or so, because they all picked it up when it launched in early January. So yeah, it's been really lovely few weeks.
Yeah. So it's actually amazing, because when I told a few friends that I was interviewing you about this book, I've actually been carrying it around. So recently I've stopped carrying a bag with me because I have a massive coat on, and on the tube I'm just like, you know what, I don't want to be faffing with a bag. But I love carrying books with me just, you know, to read on in transit. And so I've been carrying The Things That We Lost. So I've got it here with me. The other day I went for dinner and drinks with my friends, and they're like, why are you carrying a book? Like, who do you think you are? And I'm just like, I'm interviewing the author. So I'm really excited to read it. And the reaction I got was, oh my God, like, I've seen that book in Waterstones, or I've seen it on bookshelves, or it's on my to-read list, so let me know how it is. So it's a widespread sort of known book at the moment in the community, which is really exciting, and congratulations on your launch. It's huge, and I really hope you're proud of yourself.
Thank you, that's so nice to hear, and it means a lot that people have been like, it's, you know, even just the story of it and the fact that it's been written by a, you know, British Gujarati. It's the same like with my cousins and my friends. I've had a few stories of like, yeah, friends mentioning it to other friends or family, and people saying, oh yeah, I've heard about that. So it's really surreal, because I didn't really ever expect that I would have my dream of being an author ever happen. And then when it was happening, I expected the book to totally just fly under the radar and just be tucked at the back of one bookshop somewhere in London. So it's incredibly special, basically, to hear that. So thank you.
Oh, no, of course, my pleasure. And as I said, super excited to be chatting to you about this book and just about yourself. So on Brand Game Strong, what I try to do is kind of focus on understanding you, and also understanding what those cultural influences were that you had when you were growing up that inspired you to become an author, but also to write about these specific topics. Because I know that this book is probably the first of its kind that I've personally heard of from the perspective of, you know, British, Kenyan, Gujarati. And I feel like a lot of people that I know in my life, but also like, I'm not from the UK. So when I moved here, I realized there was a huge Kenyan Gujarati population.
And I feel like a lot of those people would, you know, see themselves in this book. So it's really nice that you've sort of opened this up. But again, you know, do you know of any other books that have already been around talking about this particular experience?
So yeah, I would have to say, like, I came to books written by writers from the diaspora quite late, which is quite embarrassing for me because I've always been a massive reader and I have a literature degree, and I never really picked up books by writers from the diaspora until I was in my, like, sort of, I don't know, early to mid 20s, which was quite embarrassing for someone who reads so much. And I agree with you that there have been a few books recently that have been published in sort of the last 10 years by writers from the diaspora. But I haven't really seen a book that's so much about the culture itself. I think of books like The Reading List by Sarah Nisha Adams, or I think about books like We're All Birds of Uganda, who was won by the previous Mercury winner, Hafsa Zayan. It was written by her. But they all have, like, touches of the culture in them. And it was so lovely for me to pick those books up and finally see people like me in them. Yeah. But I think this book, I think it really does focus on the culture in a way that I hadn't seen done before, in that it's very much just character driven. It's just about the family. It's just about the feelings of identity and belonging. Instead of being like a side dish to the plot, they are the main plot in a way. And I'd seen other writers do that from other communities and other diasporas, but not really ever from, like the British Gujarati Kenyan community. And like you say, you know, there's so many of us in the UK and we're in so many other industries, but we haven't really forced ourselves into the arts properly yet. Yeah. You know, there's some in film and we're now sort of writing more, but it was definitely a gap that I saw as a reader. And then I wanted to explore it as a writer.
Yeah. And you did it beautifully. I really enjoyed reading it. And I just think it's one of those books that it was just like a warm hug or like a warm cup of tea. You know, I know there's a lot of references of chai. Yeah. In the book. And there's a lot of kind of references to certain words in Gujarati. So I'm not Gujarati myself. So for me, it was quite new. But there were certain words that, you know, I was familiar with. So it was really cool that it was so authentically like woven into the storyline. And I think you did that really nicely. So I really hope that people, you know, especially within that community, but even people who are just curious about that experience, pick it up and I'm sure they'll learn something new about it. I want to take it back to kind of baby Jyoti, if you will. So where did you grow up? I believe that was, you grew up in Paris. Is that correct?
So I was born in Paris. Didn't live there for long, couple of years maximum, maybe even less than that. And my parents moved to the UK after that, and then we moved to the south of India to Bangalore. And we're from the north, we're Gujarati, which is the west. I always say it's the north, but it's actually the west because I grew up going to Bangalore a lot. I have that like Londoner thing of anything above the midpoint is the north, but Gujarat, it's the west. And we moved to Bangalore for a couple of years. And then since I was about six, we've been in London pretty much full time. But growing up, I went to France a lot. I went to Paris a lot with school and with family and stuff. And I always felt a real connection to Paris. And especially like the last couple of years going as an adult, there's definitely something very special about Paris to me. And I don't know if it was just because I was born there. My dad was very much into French culture. And we were meant to go back and live there after we lived in Bangalore. I mainly grew up in London and I definitely feel like I'm from London and that I am a Londoner. But then we have that weird thing of, you know, like I'm Gujarati and I'm Indian, but I haven't had family in India for like three generations. And, you know, when my parents lived in Bangalore with my brother and I, when, you know, we were kids, I feel more affinity to Bangalore than I do to Gujarat because we live there. And that was just by fluke. It was because my dad got a job there. But I've always struggled with that sort of where do you belong, where are you from piece, because like even though my heritage is Indian, I don't really like nick in the book know India and certainly not Gujarat. And we don't have any family there. My family haven't lived there for like three generations. Yet our customs and our traditions are very much Gujarati.
So tell me about the Kenyan side of your family then. How much of that influence has shaped your life experience growing up?
Yeah, so I believe great grandparents and grandparents moved to Kenya when there was sort of mass immigration to East Africa from India after India's independence. And I know like my grandfathers, I think at least one, if not both, worked for the British in Kenya. And then when Kenya got independence, there was mass immigration to like the UK back to India. So both my parents' families moved to the UK in the late 60s. I believe early 70s, as part of that diaspora again, that immigration and the movement. So again, never been to Kenya, but my parents will always say they're Kenyan. Like when someone says, "Where are you from?" or like they'll say Kenya. And I always found that interesting as a kid because I was like, "Really, we're from Wembley?" Like, surely the answer is India. But the way that I would say London, they say Kenya because it's where they grew up, it's where they have the most affinity, it's where their home was, and they were then, taken from that home and then lived in England, but Kenya was where they believed like was home and where they were from. And they definitely both have such an affinity with Kenya. And again, like I don't speak pure Gujarati, like the Gujarati I speak is speckled with Swahili words. And I don't know which words are Gujarati and which words are Swahili. So the Gujarati and sort of the impression that like their time in Kenya left on the Gujarati we speak to me is I can't even separate the two. They've just sort of married up. So yeah, it's quite an interesting journey because I think lots of people will relate to the British Indian, and then lots of people would relate to the British Kenyan Indian. And then also the European aspect of like my brother being born in Belgium, me in Paris, my parents lived all over Europe. I think then it's another layer as well. But I think all of it ultimately just hopefully makes me a little bit more open and like able to see different cultures and appreciate them.
Yeah, I've been nodding away vigorously because I resonate with so much of that. So my family are Sindhi, and similar to you, our families also went through kind of mass migration during the partition from Sindh, which was in Pakistan, to then India. And we don't really have a home in India, really. Like my family are from Jaipur, but Jaipur is in Rajasthan. So whenever I say that, I'm from Jaipur, they're like, "Oh, so you're Marwari or you're Rajasthani?" And I'm like, "No, I'm Sindhi," but you wouldn't be able to know. And then there's that thing of like, I grew up in Spain, so similar to you, European flavor as well thrown in there. And suddenly you're just like, who even am I? And what's interesting is also like, as we get older, our identities also shift, right? Because like, I'm hearing you speak and I'm just like, yep, she seems like a Londoner born through and through, born and bred. And I get that a lot. Like everybody assumes I grew up in London because I give off that kind of vibe. And I'm like, but you really wouldn't know. So sometimes we don't really know where that leaves us, right? And that sometimes makes us want to channel that in different ways. And I guess you've channeled it through your book. But it's nice to have somewhere to kind of just dump all those thoughts and feelings, and put them in a nice way so that other people can also experience that. And I feel like you've really done that. And I'm sure that your book is also going to kind of speak to people in that sense, because they'll see those little, tiny little references to different elements of the culture. And yeah, same as you, I use Spanish words in an Indian accent and think that it's Hindi.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do really relate to all of that. And it's again amazing that, I've never met you, but like through your book, through talking to you, I'm just like, wow, like there's so much in common, like so many similarities. So I'm sure loads of people will feel that as well. My next question to you is, what sort of things were you passionate about when you were a kid? Was it reading? Was it anything completely rogue and different?
So I was definitely very creative as a kid. I loved painting. I played the bansuri flute, which is Rajasthani music. And I was really just very creative. Loved writing, loved reading, was always playing games, always making up games for my friends to play as well. I just loved being in my imagination. But I also, like, for example, was really into football. I was a massive Arsenal fan. I loved playing it. I was very, very sporty. I played all like everything that I could. I just liked being active, both physically and then also like creatively in my mind. And I think all of that really like was quite conducive to then becoming a writer in a way, because I was spending so much time just being creative and being lost to my imagination. And yeah, I loved all of that as a kid.
Were the people around you and your family similar in that way? Or did you feel like you're a bit of a, you know, outcast or slightly different to everyone around you in that sense?
Yeah, I think like both of my parents are very creative and they both really encouraged us to be creative, which I think like I didn't realize at the time, but I think looking back, I think might have been quite rare given like the circumstances, because they both work in tech, my parents, and all of our family are like, they all went down the sort of software route. And I was the first person in my family to like go and study an arts at university. I studied English literature and then did a master's in creative writing. And the first person who didn't want to have a job that was like all in the same industry. And yeah, so I think it was definitely encouraged for me to be creative. And I think my parents as well, like I grew up around a lot of music. They're both very like, my dad can pick up any instrument and play it basically. And my mum also was very into like visual art as well, and was always like getting involved when we had art projects. So I was very lucky because I feel like my home was very much about like harnessing creativity, which I think looking back, you wouldn't have always expected given like the sort of family and the sort of like jobs and stuff that people did in my family and still do. So yeah, always very creative.
Was there ever any doubt or discussion around, oh, why are you going down a creative route? Like, that's not going to make you money. Was that ever a consideration?
Yeah, a huge one, definitely. Mm. I think it was all fun and games until I was like, I want to do this for a living. And then everyone was like, what? You can do it on the side, but you're not going to make any money from it. And yeah, so I think it was very scary, I think, because, you know, my parents had come here at a time where like they'd been very middle class in Kenya, and then they were moved to England, and all of a sudden they had to start from scratch. My grandparents, who'd been working for the British in like civil servant jobs, were now working in factories. And it was a big shift, and it was really difficult. Like a lot of Gujarati Kenyans went through the same experience, or just Gujaratis from East Africa, really. And within my parents' generation, they went back to being again middle class, just within their lifetime of like 20 years of being in the UK, if less. And that's because they worked incredibly hard. And, you know, like my mum has a PhD in computer science. My dad really worked hard and had a very successful career in tech too. And like, yeah, my brother is the same. My mum's siblings all work in tech. And when all of a sudden I was like, oh yeah, I want to take, you know, my hobby of writing and being creative and like go and study English and make it into my day job, I think it's not surprising that a lot of Gujaratis would have had the same reaction, you know, in that time, like where it was still that fear of like, how are you going to make money? But, you know, it was a privilege for me to be able to go and do that. I think that's also why historically we haven't seen many British Gujaratis or even just second generation immigrants, or certainly not first, doing that, because it's a privilege to go and study an art university, to go and, you know, spend money doing something that's not automatically going to lead to more money. Like, that's a privilege, of course it is. And I think I was able to do that, but my parents would never have been, and their parents certainly wouldn't have been able to do that. So I think, like, hopefully now, and like the generations below me, there will be more kids who are able and supported to go and do, you know, creative degrees and creative jobs. I certainly try very hard with, like, you know, my cousins and my little nieces to like say, you know, you could study art at uni or history or whatever you want, you know, because we have that privilege now. I think the mentality still hasn't caught up though, but we do have that privilege of doing that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think back to when we were stuck at home for like a year, right? And the thing that kept us going was art, because it was music, because it was film, books. And I think at that time, that was probably the first time, maybe on a mainstream level, people appreciated art in a way that it's probably not been appreciated, especially among, you know, immigrant households. And maybe you're right, that narrative is changing. And I didn't really think about it in that way before, of like, yes, it is actually a privilege, because, you know, if you're parents are able to be in a position to support you for the first few years when you come out of uni and you don't have a high paying job, or just, you know, even things like your parents being comfortable with you taking on something that's not as financially secure to start off with, that shows that, you know, the family feels like they're in a position to do that. So, and on top of that, I mean, I think it would be a shame not to pursue those kind of avenues, because that's, at the end of the day, like, that's the kind of stuff we fall back on, right? As we get older, like we start appreciating art and creative things a lot more. You know, everyone who's in corporate jobs or tech or finance, I work in tech as well. So I do relate. I have a degree in computer science, hated it, realized I was a creative at heart. And I just know that even in my head, I'm like, you know, I want to work to a certain point where I'm financially secure enough to be able to do creative things day in and day out. So I do really appreciate that point of view. So I think that's actually something I, you know, a lot of people maybe don't think about.
And that's why, you know, like when I studied English, I was one of the only people of color on my course. And yeah, that's why the arts are so full of white middle-class people, is because the immigrants in the UK and like people from marginalized communities, working class people, haven't had the privilege of doing it. It's a luxury to be able to do it, which is so sad, because I often think about all of the art and the music and the books that were never written by people who were so full of that sort of creativity, just because they didn't have the privilege and the luxury to go do that. And that's why, again, things like Murky Books exist. You know, I won the Murky Books New Writers Prize, which is how I published this book. They deliberately look for writers from minority backgrounds, because we historically haven't had the privilege of doing literature degrees, being encouraged, and the pathways aren't clear. So it sort of turns into like an echo chamber then, you know, when different voices aren't being heard and included. Yeah. But similar to you, you know how you said that you went into a career and then got to a position where you could pull back then and be creative. I ended up doing the same thing. So even though I studied English on my undergrad, I in my last year at uni, I had like 3 jobs and an internship, because I was like, I need to be able to sustain myself.
Yeah.
When I finish uni, when I graduate. And I took an internship, which was like paid like 2 months before I graduated, and it was like a year long. So I was doing my final dissertation and working full time, just because I knew that I needed to get to a place of financial stability. So for 3 or 4 years after my undergrad, I did not write at all. I worked so hard to climb the corporate ladder, and I have a career in marketing now in the tech industry as well. Ended up there, even though I did everything not to. I worked hard, really hard, for like 3 or 4 years, climbed really high up. And when I was in like a head of position, was like, right, now I can pull back a bit and cruise for a couple of years. And that's when I started writing the book. And then I went part time to do the master's. But I think that's definitely that practical Gujarati South Asian mindset of like, even though I did a creative degree, I was like, I need to go earn some money and, you know, pay my bills before I could actually do anything with this degree.
We're going to come on to your book in a sec, but I want to ask you a last question on this topic, which is, do you think that was a waste of time?
Which bit do you mean?
The marketing bit, the corporate ladder bit.
No, I don't, because I feel like there's something that's so true, that's so underrated, which is that the more of life you experience, the better art you can create. And I know it's like really annoying when you're young and you're like straight out of uni, you're like, I want to write a best-selling novel. But those few years when I wasn't writing, when I actually sat down to write this book, it flew out of me, and I had so much creativity and so, like 4 years worth of stored up like energy to like channel into this book. And I think those 4 years taught me so much about life generally that I could then put in the book. You know, it showed me like I grew up in those few years. And then when I came to writing, I wrote the book as an adult, as opposed to like a kid writing fan fiction, which is what I was doing when I was like 16 or whatever. And also, I'm someone who I've been asked a lot in interviews, like, oh, will you leave your day job now? And I'm like, absolutely not, because the energy that I get from doing my day job and the part of my brain that I'm using when I'm doing my day job, it's almost like my warm-up act, so that when I come to write in the evening, I'm rearing to go. I feel like if I had a whole week, a whole empty week to just write, I would probably write less than I do when I work full time, and be more anxious and worried about how like good I am as an author. But because I have something to keep me grounded and focused during the week, then when I write on the weekends and the evenings, I don't have the luxury of procrastination, or, you know, I just have to get to it. And I actually think like those 4 years of working and then also working and then being an author on the side, like they fuel each other, as opposed to one getting in the way or like eclipsing the other one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that actually that narrative is changing now in the mainstream, isn't it? Where like it's okay to have a side hustle and keep it as a side hustle and not want to turn into, you know, dream about turning into like a dream job. because at the end of the day, you might start to hate it, or, you know, things will change, the dynamic will shift. And actually, when you have a full-time job, and I'm the same, I run this podcast on the side, and a couple other things. And actually, I think I've come to the conclusion that I'm happy to have, like, you know, one foot in different things, because that gives me confidence, because I know that one day, if, you know, my day job didn't go that well, it's okay. I've got a great podcast lined up in the evening, you know, and it kind of just refreshes your mind. So from that perspective,
it does. And it's one of those things that I think is much more, it's much healthier. So like for me, like say, for example, I have a bad day with the book, or I think, oh, that's okay, I've got my day job. Or if I have a bad day at the day job, I think, well, I'm an author as well. So do you know what I mean? I think it's really good to like be balanced and to have those multiple like strings to your bow, and to, it keeps you grounded as well, you know, I think. So yeah.
No, absolutely. So moving on to the things that we lost. So your debut book, really exciting. So it was previously called Six of One, is that correct? And what did that name mean? And what kind of spurred you on to change the name?
So that's, I've never been asked that in an interview before. So thank you. Very few people know that. So it was called Six of One for a long time. And it's because of the idiom, six of one and half a dozen of the other, which is basically a way of saying two things are equivalent and equal the same. It's about this idea of equivalence. And a lot of the book is about equivalence, you know, Nick's parts of his identity, that there's so many recurring images of like the two roads, you know, like the Robert Frost poem of like, you know, which path to take. And, you know, in the end, hopefully they lead you to the same place. And it was my editor, actually. I said from the start, I was like, I'm so up for changing it because I don't like it. But everyone else seemed to like it more than me. And it was very much like a placeholder title. And it was quite, I think, maybe like halfway through the edits that my editor said to me, how would you think about changing? What would you think about changing the title? And I was like, so up for that. And she said, how about the things that we lost? And I just got goosebumps. I was like, that's the title. Like, I knew immediately. I was like, I don't even want to hear any others. Like, that is the title of the book. I can hear it in Avni's voice. And then towards the end of the book, I can hear Nick saying the same thing. You know, it's so all-encompassing of like so much of what the novel's about.
Yeah. I felt that as well when I was reading it, because I was like, yes, this is the diaspora experience, as well as obviously the topics on grief that you touch on, and so much more than just like losing individuals. It's also losing like certain dynamics, certain mindsets. And I think a lot of that has been portrayed throughout this. So it does cover a lot. And it actually is a very representative title of the story. How long did this book take you to write, and what actually inspired you to tell the story from Avni and Nick's perspective, as opposed to, say, you know, Paul's perspective or Elliot's perspective?
Yeah, so I did my undergrad, didn't write for a few years. And then out of nowhere, this conversation between Nick and Rohan, the first chapter, sort of came to me. And I was grappling with like my own identity at the time. I was a Londoner but living outside of London, and more often than I'd like, coming across this question of like, where are you from? Or like, I'd say London and it wasn't good enough, it would then be like, where were you born? Paris. Where were your parents born? Kenya. And I was like, you're trying to ask me what kind of brown I am, the answer's Indian. But I was always like very stuck when it came to this sense of identity and being too British when I was in London around my Gujarati mates, but then too Indian and too brown when I was living in Norfolk around my white mates. Like I felt like I couldn't just be me. And I think I started writing this book because I wanted to interrogate how so many people who don't have the privilege of being brought up in the country that their cultural heritage is tied to struggle with this question of like balancing the parts of their identity. And people feel like that in so many different ways. Like, I've got friends who grew up in very working class households who are working in jobs where they're surrounded by very upper class people, and they feel their accent change, they feel their personalities adapting. And it's something that we all do, we all code switch in so many different ways. But I wanted to look at the code switching around like heritage and identity, and like race essentially. So I started writing this book, and within 3 months I had a very messy, unexpected draft of a novel. I'd given up on the idea of being a writer. I tried to write in those years and nothing was coming, and I thought, okay, maybe I'm just going to be a content marketing manager and that's it, and maybe being an author was a dream that I let go of now. And I was so happy to like greet the writer in me again, and I was so happy that this novel came to me. So I applied to do a master's at the University of East Anglia, started that maybe like a year and a few months after I'd written that first draft. And it was during that master's that I really unpacked and unpicked the plot. And that's when the first draft was written. From Nick's perspective, I brought in Avni because I realized we need her for that dramatic irony and the tension to charge through. And without her perspective, we don't get her backstory with Elliot. We don't get their love story. We don't understand how she becomes the woman she does because of what she's been through in her own life with her own parents. It allowed me to bring in like the 70s and the 80s in a really lovely way. So I started writing in the summer of 2018. And then, you know, I finished my master's, my degree, and I think it was September of 2020. And then I won the Murky Books Prize in the April of 2021. And then here we are in January, February of 2023 when the book's out. So it was like at the time it felt really stop start, but looking back, it was like a perfect roller coaster. Like it made sense how everything worked out.
Yeah. Gosh, that is quite a while to be sitting on a story. And sometimes I think we don't realize how many years go into a particular piece of work because we just see the final result, right? So we're just like, oh yeah, cool. She probably wrote it in a few months and it's out now. Great. And for you to say like, you know, you've been writing it pretty much thinking about it since 2018, that's pretty good. And like power to you for persevering as well with it.
It's one of those things that I think, you know, some people read a book like this in a couple of days, some people maybe take them up to a month, but there's like 4 or 5 years of the author's head in that one book that takes, you know, up to a month to read or whatever. And I actually think it was really good that it took me that long, because one of the things that I've been told a lot is that it's something that keeps coming up is like the characters feel real. And I think that's because they were with me for so long, because even in that time, you know, I'd work on the book for 3 months, leave it for 6 months, pick it up for a month, leave it for another 6 months. I wasn't constantly working on it. And then even when I was editing it, I'd give it to my editor for 3 months, then work on it again for a month, give it back to her. But when I wasn't working on it, I was thinking and I was wondering what the characters would be doing, where I was unpicking parts of the plot that were leading me to dead ends. And that thinking time when you're not actually at your desk writing is just as important as actually doing the job and writing.
How did you manage the plot and storyline and remember all the characters and what they were going through?
So I've got a very messy folder in a cupboard just over there, which looks like a psycho folder, because it's like I had a red pen that was so lovely to write with, but it was red. And I have like timelines of every character, when they're born, when their kids are born, when they move to the UK, when their birthday is, like, you know, at what point they get married, like it's all perfectly plotted. And I look back at it the other week, so I was moving a house, and I thought, God, this looks quite scary because it's all in red. And it's all like tiny little writing. But that really helped. So whenever I was in a chapter and I was like, oh God, how old would Chan be at this point? Or what music would be playing? Or what would, like, there's like a few references to, for example, like the Arsenal football team, like which players would be in the team at that point? And I would go and look at this little timeline and be like, okay, he was born in, like, Avni's born in 72, so at this point she'd be 38 or whatever. So that really helped, like being very meticulous and like detailed. But coming back to your question, like in terms of the story and the plot, this novel started with the characters. It's a very character-driven book. They came to me first and I followed them to see where they would lead me. And it was just after I got shortlisted or longlisted for the Murky Prize. So in the December of 2020, I just finished my master's and I came out of there with, I went into the master's with a 50K draft, came out of it with like 15,000 words intact. I started writing the story basically from scratch. And in that December, I got COVID and I was really annoyed because I was like, I want to use my Christmas break to finish writing this book. And instead, I just laid in bed for like 10 days and I would think about the characters for like an hour and say, what if they go down this path? What would happen? No, that doesn't work. Let's bring them back. What if they went this way? And it was in that time that I'd hit a brick wall for like probably about a year with the plot. But that week where I just sat and meditated on it, I came out healthy and fixed from COVID, but also able to finish the plot and figure out where they were actually going to end up. And then I spent like a couple of months just smashing out every day after work. And then it was the week that I finished that draft was the week I found out I won the book deal with Merky. So it was a lot of serendipity there. But the plot was something I did really struggle with because I sort of followed them and they led me to a dead end. And I sort of had to bring them back and then say, let's try again a few times.
Mm.
But there were lots of spreadsheets and stuff like that, that like plot it all out and figure it out.
That's what I was thinking when you were talking about the plot and how you came up with it. So I was just thinking, gosh, I feel like this is the, you know, content marketing manager, Jyothi, coming out. And, you know, the way you described writing the plot and trying dead ends and then being like, oh, that didn't work. That actually, that sounds to me like writing code. So it's very interesting because, you know, we always think, oh, yeah, I'm going to go down a maths and logic and science route, or I'm going to go down a creative route and become a writer. But actually what you demonstrated writing this book is that you've exercised both parts of your brain, which is really something we don't think of all the time because we always think of it as so binary, right? But actually you've seamlessly somehow managed to like weave in every element of your life and your abilities into this book, which is I think really cool. And it just sounds very, very like structured and logical, you know.
I'll definitely let my my mum and my brother know that when I next speak to them, they'll love that because they code, so they'll love that. So thank you. Yeah, it's nice to think about it in that way, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you can apply that to so many different, you know, avenues or types of creative work as well. It doesn't always have to be like, you know, when you think of creatives, you think of like messy desk and, you know, lots of tattoos, you know, dyed hair and just like sitting there all day trying to just draw something or write something. And that probably a lot of it is probably that as well. So it's nice that kind of we're able to bring our own flavors to what we do and, you know, not stereotype necessarily. So my next question for you was, if you were to be friends with Avni, right? And you'd kind of seen her go through everything. So you were her best friend. What would you tell her today, having kind of seen her go through that journey? Would you have been there for her in a particular way? Like if, for example, you had someone in your life who was going through something very similar with grief and not being able to necessarily talk about it openly all the time, how would you treat them and what would you say or do?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. I think the answer takes us right back to one of the main points in the book, which is that historically, like, you know, South Asians haven't really like acknowledged mental health issues or ever really, it's not really in our culture to like go and get therapy. Like it would be like a middle-class white person who's grown up in Chelsea. Like we haven't really looked at that and we haven't caught up with like the West when it comes to that. And what I would say to her is like, particularly towards the end of the book, but even if I knew her throughout, which would be like, you actually need to find a way to process this properly. And because we're talking about, to be for anyone who hasn't read the book, like, so Avni tragically loses her husband when she's sort of 26, 27. He's her childhood sweetheart. And she's basically unable to talk about what happened to him, even talk to her son, Nick, about their life together. And when she's pregnant with Nick, that's when she loses her husband. So her son never meets his dad. And she also doesn't know she's pregnant when her husband dies. So it adds an extra layer of like complexity because her husband always really wanted a kid. She wasn't so keen on it. And then she finds out she's pregnant after he dies. It's just, yeah, very, very, a lot to go through. So yeah, I would like, if that was like one of my mates, I would say to her, which is something that like sort of Nick comes up against in the book later on, is, you know, like finding a way of reprocessing this stuff efficiently and effectively and in a way that's actually going to help you move on with your life. Because it's just something that I don't feel like is even in Gujarati vocabulary, for example.
No, it's true. It's actually language is so powerful in that way because I always think, you know, being multilingual, we have a visibility of how these languages are different, like how English is different to Gujarati, or for, in my case, it would be Hindi or Sindhi. And sometimes there just aren't words to describe it. And it says a lot about our culture and how we've grown up, just not, or maybe like brushing things under the carpet just because there's not really a way to talk about it. Have you experienced, I guess within maybe your own remit, your own sort of orbit, have you experienced these themes within your own life of, you know, maybe having poor mental health and not being able to talk about it, or people going through grief, you going through grief, and kind of dealing with it in that particular way?
Yeah, I definitely, like, throughout my whole life being Gujarati, have seen the way that we talk about mental health or grief or anything like that being so different to the way that I see, like, my white British friends' families talk about it, or the way I've seen Americans in Hollywood talk about it, where it's really like, it's like almost like a some sort of really messed up, like, status symbol to, like, have a therapist in a way, where it's like the opposite in Gujarati culture, in many ways historically in British culture, to even acknowledge, like, mental health. So it's definitely something that I could see, like we were talking about with language, where you can see, if you're multilingual, you can see blind spots and overlap between these two languages in a way that someone who only knows one language wouldn't see. And it was the same when I was growing up with mental health, with grief, where I could see the way that Gujaratis and South Asians, particularly the ones like that I was, like, the community I was part of growing up in the UK, processed and dealt with things like mental health or grief versus how it was depicted in film, in TV, in the people around me who weren't Gujarati. And, like, specifically with Nick, he's an 18-year-old who's mixed race, white British father, Gujarati British mother. And I look with him, like, the way that he's unable to articulate what goes on with his mental health and the way he's unable to process grief too, because, you know, he grows up in two cultures, both of which there's a big silence around mental health. Historically in Britain, like, men haven't really had the encouragement and the space and the safety to talk openly about mental health. And it's the same with Gujarati culture. Like, we don't have words for anxiety or depression and panic attacks. So I wanted to look at what you have, like, what happens when you have a marriage of these two cultures and a character who is literally from both of these cultures which have silences around mental health, and then what happens when he struggles with his mental health. And, like, in the book, I never use the words panic attack, anxiety, depression, even though he struggles with those things, because I wanted to, you know, like you were saying at the beginning of the conversation where I use Gujarati words, I wanted, like, the form to reflect what I'm doing with the plot and the story, and that, you know, I don't use those words because he doesn't have access to those words in terms of the way he's been socialized and raised.
Mm. I noticed that actually very specifically with Avni, when she was kind of going through certain stuff, obviously with after having lost her husband. And I noticed that you were describing the symptoms, but you weren't talking about what was happening. And it was very much coming from the perspective of a family who maybe doesn't really know how to talk about these things in like normal language. And you touch on men's mental health a lot in this book. Was there a specific kind of, I guess, spark in you or something that made you want to touch on that particular theme? Because it's something that we're starting to talk about more, especially, you know, South Asian men's mental health, but it's not really spoken about still. And especially with the men in our lives. I mean, I don't really experience it as with all the men that, you know, openly, the way that sometimes us women might talk about how we're feeling. So what was kind of the affinity that you had personally to that theme or topic?
So I think a lot of this book is about bringing forth things that haven't been on bookshelves. So, like, the Gujarati, Kenyan, British experience, etc. You know, the way that Avni, you know, processes her grief or fails to process it, her territorial nature. Like, these are all things that we see, but we just haven't seen in literature. And it was, again, like, when it comes to, like, the men in the book, so much of the book is about their mental health, but also so much of the book is about tenderness between men and, like, platonic male intimacy, which, again, like, I just hadn't seen so much in books. Like, I remember reading Caleb Azuma Nelson's Open Water, and he's got a male British Ghanaian protagonist who cries. And I was so, like, taken by the fact that I was seeing in this book a Black man just being able to cry, because historically we haven't seen, like, Black men in art being able to be vulnerable. It's not a storyline that art has focused on, even though of course they cry, everyone cries. And I wanted to do something similar with my book, where so much of it is about brown men holding space for each other and being kind to each other. And even when it comes to Nick, like in the end, it's a lot of the men around him who hold him up. So like Theo and Will and Papa Burns and like Dan, and in the end, John as well. Like I wanted to show moments of like tenderness and intimacy between men. And I also wanted to explore male mental health, because I just felt like these were all topics that I'd seen alluded to quietly in books, or, you know, sort of touched upon, but not really properly explored. So it was just one of the other aspects of the novel that I just really thought needed to be written about and spoken about, because it just hasn't been. And one of the nicest things that's like come off the back of the book is, so you've got a proof copy there, which is like an early copy, so ignore the spelling mistakes. The final copy is like perfectly edited, but that's like an early version. So I gave that to a few of my friends, and a couple of them like came back to me after reading it and said, like, this book made me want to talk to the men in my life about how they're doing. It made me want to like have a cup of tea and be like, how's work? Like, what's going on? How are you feeling? Like, because they noticed like some of the ways that I was describing Nick's struggle or Elliot's struggle, they could see that behavior and thought like, oh God, like I need to have conversations here. And that's one of the most beautiful things I think that's come out of this experience for me, is like opening up that conversation, and in many ways in the book, showing people how to have those conversations. They don't need to be scary. Like it's so easy to just go for a walk with a mate and ask them how they're doing. And, you know, I show all of that in the book.
Yeah. And I think it just shows your caliber as a writer, because again, like you said, you don't throw the words around. And I feel in pop culture, in society, and on social media, we hear these words being said a lot and without a trigger warning, unfortunately. But then I think when you talk about people's behaviors, the way that their eyes are, the way their expressions are, or the things that they're saying that kind of say a lot more than what they've said, basically, that's really beautiful. Because I know, you know, we live in an era where, you know, nonfiction is just like rife. It's just like, yes, you know, How to Change Your Habits and all this. And I probably have quite a few of those behind me. But fiction actually is very underrated when it comes to talking about things like that, you know, topical subjects and things that affect us in our day-to-day life. So whenever I talk to my friends who read fiction, they're like, yeah, but, you know, there's a lot to learn from fiction as well, and the way that it draws from the author's real lives over many years, like you said. So no, I'm glad that it's being written about, and I'm glad it's being written about from an intergenerational lens as well, which is something you've done really well, with like talking about Nick's experience as a teenager, talking about Babu's experience as well. He was one of my favorite characters, by the way, Avni's dad. I just feel like he kind of, I don't know, he's just there throughout the entire book, you know, in some form or another, woven into the entire story across the different eras. And I love, actually, there was one chapter where, or a few chapters where you described him from when he was younger, when Avni was a kid. And I find that so interesting how he then becomes, you know, he becomes like when he's elderly and, you know, vulnerable. So it's really, yeah, I don't know, just very real.
I really wanted to have like, because there are some unsavory characters in the book, and I really wanted to have like him and like Papa Burns as well, so Will's dad, as like two very stable, loving, just pure good people in Nick's life and in Avni's life. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but something that you said made me think as well, which was when you were talking about like fiction and nonfiction. Because I remember when I went and did my master's, one of my tutors very early on said to me, like, you're talking about race, identity, belonging. There's like a subtext quietly to like the fact that the fictive present is set around like the Brexit referendum. And you talk very quietly without overdoing it about Brexit too. And he was like, why is this not nonfiction? Why have you made it a story? Why don't you just write about these things? Because more people will learn. I was like, absolutely not. More people will learn if it's fiction. Because what you're doing is you're writing a story that people will buy into, and they won't realize they're learning. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's exactly like you're saying, you can learn so much from fiction because it's so enjoyable to be nestled within your imagination, within a story. But then, you know, someone who lives in a village in Scotland would learn so much about London culture and so much about Gujarati culture. And they would learn about like what it genuinely feels like to be someone who's mixed race or from multiple different places growing up in like contemporary Britain in a very like authentic way, but without having to have the heaviness and like the lecture style of reading nonfiction. So it was something that I'm really glad you've spoken about, because it's something that I think about a lot, and I think it's so underrated how much you can learn about like from fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the art of storytelling is probably the best way to teach, isn't it? I think I've learned that quite recently at work.
It is. And also, like, if you think about like Hindu culture or Gujarati culture, like South Asian culture, so much of like our traditions are based around oral storytelling. And, you know, like the epics, the Hindu epics, like so much of what we learn is through story. And yeah, I remember as well, like Nick's like really into like the Mahabharata, but like for me, my brother, we watched the Mahabharata, like the TV version with my granddad growing up. And like, I learned so much about, like, it was basically like Game of Thrones epic style TV before that was a thing, because you'd have like so many hours. They'd probably be like 31 hour long episodes of like the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, like on, you know, little VHS tapes. And it was like, we would literally binge watch like these episodes before binge watching was a thing. And I learned so much about storytelling through that too, growing up.
How amazing. That's actually incredible, because I watched Mahabharata too. And actually it's true. Like we've grown up with, you know, hearing all these stories and watching these epics and people in very over the top outfits, but you know, it's, I guess that we draw inspiration from all of those things. So I know you've mentioned, oh, sorry, I cut you off. Were you going to say something?
Oh no, I was just agreeing. You just said, absolutely.
Okay. So you are one of Observer's 10 best new novelists. And you've also mentioned that you won the Murky Books New Writers Prize. You come across as super confident to me. When you wrote this book, did you ever have self-doubt? Did you feel that? I mean, you talked about it, didn't you? You said that, yeah, I didn't think was going to be an author. But when you were writing that initial scrappy draft over the first few months, did you ever feel like, what am I doing? And when you won that prize or those two kind of accolades, did you think, okay, I can do this? Like, what went through your mind?
So it's so nice to hear that you say that I seem confident, because I was literally saying this to someone last night, that I have zero confidence when it comes to like my creativity and my writing, and things like winning the Murky Prize and getting on that list, like the Observer's top 10 debut novelists of the year. Like, I was so overcome and was so like overjoyed and was so teary when I found out. But I spent probably about a week emailing my publicist or emailing Murky saying, are you sure there's not been a mistake? Like, are you absolutely sure? And waiting for it to be taken away. And I think, like, I get quite annoyed because I've heard quite a lot of people recently be like, oh, imposter syndrome, so 2015. And I'm like, but I think there is so much to be said about why people who look like me and come from the background I come from feel imposter syndrome when we do have success in the arts. And that's because we've never seen people who look like us do this. So like when I was writing this book, I genuinely did not think it was going to be published. And I think that's why it is so like tender and why it is so character driven and so raw, is because I wrote it totally from my heart, thinking no one is ever going to read this. And when it won the Murky Prize, for many months after that, I was expecting a phone call to say, we actually made a massive mistake. You're the wrong Jyoti Patel, because there were so many in the UK. And it was the same when I won the Observer thing. When I got the Observer shortlist, I was, you know, when I made that list, I thought, absolutely, there's been a definite mistake here. And I don't have a lot of self-confidence. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that growing up, I never saw a British brown, like Gujarati writer doing this. There was no one I could look up to from even a similar background. Like the writers who I was most taken by were like Jhumpa Lahiri, or more recently like Avni Doshi, who were all in America, you know. And even then, like Avni, Jhumpa Lahiri's story, the namesake, is about like a Bengali family who live in America, and I'm Gujarati living in London. Like, it's not even remotely close, but it was the closest I could find. So I think, like, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said about why creatives from minority backgrounds, from working class backgrounds, do end up having a lot of imposter syndrome and like constantly questioning why they're allowed to be in these spaces, because we've never seen people who look like us in these spaces or writing books like this. So even when I got the book deal and I was working with my editor and my agent, like, I kept I kept expecting them to say, oh, actually, you're going to have to change the story quite a lot for it to be marketable, for it to be sellable, because like you said at the beginning of this conversation, like a story like this hasn't really been done in this way. And for example, like after I won the Mercury Prize, I had to go then and find an agent. And I had a lot of agents saying, I really want to sign you, but I just don't know how I would market this book, because by definition, it hadn't been done. And, you know, often when you have writers who are very high literary and people don't know how to market the book, they take it straight away because they're like, oh, it's still, even though it's so unique, it's still within a certain type of canon, or it's within a certain type of genre that I know, even though it's never been done before, it's guaranteed to like be reviewed and be, you know, be well received in certain circles. Whereas this one, like, who know, no one knew that there's a big appetite for Gujarati British readers, you know, and no one knew that people who weren't from that community would still want to pick up this book because it does talk about universal themes. So what I'm trying to say is like the environment of publishing, but also my history of not seeing people who look like me and my history of just not feeling like validated in many ways by the industry historically were all very conducive to me feeling imposter syndrome and not confident when it came to my writing. It's only now in the last couple of months that I will, when I meet people, say, I work in marketing, but I'm also an author, or, you know, I will say that I write or I have a novel. It's only in the last couple of months, even though I've been doing this for years and I've had this book deal for 2 years, like I just wouldn't talk about it.
And it really struck me that you said you would say things like, I write, I have a novel. You wouldn't necessarily always be like, yep, I'm an author, or, you know, that I kind of split my time 50-50, and it's not something that would come that easily. There's something around, you know, maybe being afraid to also put labels on ourselves. And there's something definitely around not allowing ourselves into the spaces. And it's not our fault. Like I have, you know, a few other creative things I do, but only like even at work, sometimes I feel I don't allow myself to belong in there, because I've always been told, yeah, you're never going to be good enough. Like you're never going to fit in. And like, how dare you be brown and be a woman and try to be partner in your company, you know, especially being how you are, you're like too nice, you know, or you're too creative, or, you know, how can you be all these things? And I think there's so much unlearning required, but like, it's exhausting trying to do that work, isn't it? Because we just want to get on with it. Like, I just want to, you know, keep doing my stuff and not have this constant voice in my head of like, you don't belong, or, you know, you're in the wrong place, or you need to work extra hard to earn this seat on the table. And I know you said it's, you know, in creative spaces, but trust me, it's everywhere. And we're breaking through it now, but gosh, like, I mean, I'm not sure like what generation you fit yourself in, but I'm millennial. And, you know, we're especially that generation where like we have constantly, you know, been told that we can and can't do certain things. And now we see, I don't know about you, but when I look at the younger generation of diaspora kids or sort of second generation South Asians, I'm like, you're so different. Like, I don't even know who I'm preaching to, probably to myself sometimes, because you don't have those fears that I have. It's a very weird position to be in. I don't know. Do you relate to that
feeling? I do. So much of what you've just said is why as well, like I chose to look at Avni being someone who grew up in the UK and was born in the UK, because she's straddling both of those things, as our generation is and as Nick's is as well, in that sense of like, we can see the kids underneath us performing their identity and performing the way that they belong in the world and the way they've been socialized. But then we can also see that we're different to like the way our parents did all those things. And we're in like the middle of both. And so much of this book is about being in the middle of things, and being too much of one or not enough of the other, etc. But like a lot of what you're saying is really resonating with me too, because I feel like I talk about this in the book with Avni too. Like again, it links back to the how we started this conversation about like, you know, the privilege that the lower generations have of being able to embrace creativity, being able to embrace other things, because their parents are no longer fresh into the country and struggling and trying to earn a living. And we're slowly letting go of some of those fears as we go down, you know, and as we've been in the UK for longer, and as we've sort of, because even like owning books and being able to watch films and study films in a way of when you watch a film and then talk about it for half an hour with your mate, like all of that is a privilege. Being able to own books, being able to have the leisure time to read, all of these things are a privilege. Which is why our generation and the ones below us are throwing themselves into it more, because we're allowed, we have the privilege of the time, and you know, they're not having to worry about, you know, having three jobs and, you know, working in the factory, etc. So it's really that really interests me, like the way that the generations move and the way that we pick up new things, we let go of things, the things that, like we say, we've lost and the things that we found, and the way it works between generations.
Yeah. We're just not in survival mode as much anymore.
Exactly it. This is exactly it. We're not in survival mode. But I think, again, like the mentality hasn't caught up with that. So like I see sometimes like my parents or my grandparents saying things and being like, oh no, you must turn the tap off immediately. And I'm like, it's okay. Like, it's okay to leave it on for an extra second now. Put pennies in the meter the way we used to. Like, we'll still be frugal, but we don't have to be so worried. We're no longer in survival mode. But so many of those traumas and that adrenaline is still in the psyche and the body, you know?
It's in our DNA. It's our intergenerational trauma, isn't it? You read about it online, and it's so true, because there's certain things that my white counterparts wouldn't feel scared about the way that I would. You know, what if it all gets, you know, taken from under my feet? What do I do then? Start from scratch. And it's something that, I don't know, I do speak to my parents about as well, because my dad was someone who worked, you know, like crazy hard and didn't read books, didn't have the time, you know, just worked. And that was all it was. And someone said about him that if you had to do it all over again, you would. And that is really powerful, but actually kind of scary, that like we always feel like we're in that sort of, I guess, danger zone. Something that the younger generation just won't have. Like when we're parents, I'm not a parent at the moment, but you know, when I become a parent, I'm sure I'm going to project some of that unknowingly. But no, this is such a fabulous, wonderful conversation. And I really hope everybody picks up your book, The Things That We Lost, and just enjoys it with a cup of tea, because it talks about tea a lot. So you will feel very validated. But
so much chai in the book, and loads of Gujarati food too.
I love it.
Yeah, make sure you've got snacks and chai as you read.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise you will get hungry. I had a couple of last questions before we wrap up for today for you, Jyoti. So the first one is, so what are you working on now? Can you give us a bit of a sneak peek, or tell us a bit?
I can, definitely. So I am working on my next novel, which is also going to be about British Gujarati family set in London. There's still going to be lots of family secrets, but it's going to be a much lighter read. The Things That We Lost is quite meditative and contemplative, and really quite like it's quite dark in like a lot of the themes that it looks at. But the next book is a lot lighter and a lot funnier and a lot quicker to read, and much more of a like a fast-paced sort of book. And this time it's going to follow a young British female protagonist. So a woman who's Gujarati British in sort of her late 20s, as she's navigating friendships and love and life. And I'm so excited. And, you know, we talked about plot, but with the next book, it is so perfectly planned out. Every single chapter, the arc in each chapter, like everything is so perfectly planned, because I don't want to come across the same hurdle I did the first time. So I'm taking my time to like get to know the characters. And I'm so open to see if they lead me somewhere else. But at the moment, it's like very perfectly planned out. And I just can't wait to get writing and to get it done. So I'm looking forward to that feeling of like when you finish work and you can't wait to get back to your characters.
I love that for you. I'm so happy and I'm so excited already to read the next one. My last question for you is, Jyoti, what do you have strong game in?
So I would say that as of the last couple of really weeks, month, I have strong game in saying I'm an author and being confident and proud of the fact that I've done this, and really trying hard to undo, to undo like a lot of the questioning and the doubt that has existed in me, I think, and finally being able to own the fact that I'm an author and be proud of it. And, you know, like when, for example, like the day that, you know, the Observer list came out, I walked to my local like supermarket to pick it up in the morning. And as I was walking, one of my neighbors who lives a few floors above me was walking back to the flat with the Observer tucked under his arm. And it just filled me with joy, and it felt so real to me. I was like, okay, like this is it. Like I'm an author, and I'm on that list that he's going to look at in a minute. And when I go past my local bookshops and I see the book, all of that has really made me feel like I am an author. And whether there are people listening who don't have that yet, it doesn't matter. Like if you're a creative, say you're a creative and own it. And it doesn't matter if you can't see someone exactly like you from your journey above you that you can look up to as a mentor. Like you can be that person for yourself and be that person for the people to generations underneath you. So yeah, that's what I'd like to end on, is that I've become like strong game and saying I'm an author and that I did this and I'm proud of it and I'm proud of me.
Yes, I love that. And actually your book is a tangible physical piece of proof that you are worth every minute of that title of author. And but also, like, I think it can apply to anything, right? Your work, your experience, it will speak for itself, because it does translate into us being able to bring more of what we can offer into the world with even more confidence, because not having that confidence is probably the only thing that holds us back from bringing that art into the world or whatever it is that we're passionate about. So no, power to you, Jyoti. Thank you so much for your time today. It was a pleasure chatting to you, and I can't wait to see all the other amazing work that you're going to do and produce in the world and read the books that you're going to write.
Thank you so much. It's been such a lovely conversation. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I hope that listeners perhaps like pick it up and enjoy reading it. And I'm sure I'll send you the next book too when that's out. So thanks.
Yep. And I'll put down all the links in the description of the podcast if you do want to purchase the book and follow Jyoti and all of that. So look out for that.